There we go. Okay. So we'll start out with a few introductions. We'll start here in the front row. No, I'm kidding. This is me. My name is Todd Clint. I'm a SharePoint MVP. I have been since 2006. The MVP designation does not mean that I'm very smart. That will become apparent very soon in this session. But it just means that I'm chatty, that I'm out in the community, that I like to answer questions. I blog. It's an exposure thing. So if you see anybody that's an MVP, that means they're friendly and helpful and all that kind of stuff, but not necessarily smart. So get your expectations set correctly when you talk to us. But I'm a writer, so this lovely tome just came out here about a month ago. You can get it over here as well. It is my mom tells me that it's the definitive work on SharePoint 2013 administration. So she wouldn't lie to me. But you can get this at Amazon or any fine booksellers. So I'd appreciate if you pick a copy of that up. Obviously, do some speaking. I'm here with you guys. I was in New Orleans a couple of weeks ago. I've got a blog out there. You're going to hear a lot about my blog. A couple of my favorite things are, you know, finding money in a pair of pants that I didn't know that I had and talking about my blog, kind of two of my favorite things. So out there, I'm an IT pro. I'm like you guys. I did Active Directory for a while. I did SQL. I did Exchange. Now I'm doing SharePoint. So in my blog, I talk a lot about SharePoint, PowerShell, SQL. Got the surfaces. Who here got their cheap surfaces all ordered? Excellent, excellent. So I got mine a couple weeks ago in New Orleans, and I've been enamored with it ever since. So right now, I'm going through that honeymoon phase with the Surface and Windows 8 devices. I've got some blog posts about that, but I promise I'll be back to SharePoint blog posts pretty quick. But you can get those there. I used to work for a company called SharePoint 911, and we were recently acquired by Rackspace. So you can go to SharePoint 911 to find out about the SharePoint stuff that we do, or rackspace.com. You can email me, todd.clint@rackspace.com. Feel free to email me any kind of questions you have. The easier the question, the more likely I will actually reply. I'm good with yes and no questions. I'm not so good with, can you map out this architecture for me? Those questions kind of sit for a while. I'm also on Twitter. You can hit me up at Todd Clint. I'm fairly responsive there. And also, every week I do a live SharePoint netcast, where I just kind of talk about the things that have happened in SharePoint during the week. I'll be talking about this. I conveniently record it live at 2:30 in the morning for you guys on Tuesday morning. So feel free to stay up for that. It ends up being 8:30 p.m. local time for me on Monday night. So feel free to stay up and watch that live. I've got a chat room. You can ask questions. We can chat. But you can also go to my blog and download the past episodes, so you don't have to stay up if you don't want to. And that the URL for that's at the bottom. And now, my lovely assistant Corey will introduce himself.
Hi, everybody. My name is Corey Burke. I'm a SharePoint architect for a hosting company called Rackspace. Todd mentioned a minute ago. I'm not an MVP, but I do have a couple of writing credits to my name. So you'll find my name in a very, very, very small print somewhere in the middle of Todd's book.
Cleverly hidden somewhere in here.
As a contributing author. As well as a technical editor for beginning SharePoint 2013, Building Business Solutions, put out by Jennifer Mason and Laura Rogers. I do have a blog, which it's somewhat SharePointy, but contains a lot of PowerShell, because I do a lot of PowerShell sort of code for resolving customer issues, that kind of stuff. And I like to put that code up there for other people to be able to use and see. You can also reach me at Twitter at Twitter, which is up there.
Yep. So to save money, I didn't put an agenda slide up, but the agenda for this is just going to be kind of what you need to know about SharePoint 2013 administration. For those of you, anybody here touch a little product called SharePoint 2010? All right. So you guys are going to be going to have a leg up. There's a lot of things that are similar, but we're going to talk about a lot of things that are new also. Throughout the session, if you've got a question, go ahead and raise your hand. We'll try to answer it if we can. And I'll repeat the question for everybody who's not us that can't hear it. If it's something we have to get real deep into the woods on, I'll probably have you come ask us at the Ask the Experts right after this over there. But we'll try to do what we can during the session. So let's go ahead and talk a little bit. For the first few slides here, we're going to talk about what it takes to get SharePoint installed and what it takes to get SharePoint going. As we all know, SharePoint's just an application. It needs some support from its friends. And so the first friend that it needs some support with is Windows. SharePoint 2013 will run on top of Windows 2008 R2 SP1, or the preferred platform, at least my preferred platform, is Windows 2012. And I made a decision about a year ago to kind of install everything on Windows 2012, get past that really tough figuring out how you shut the thing down. The UI was kind of challenging, but got that figured out. Did anybody download the Windows 2012 R2 preview on Monday when it came out? You were probably all stuck here and couldn't actually download it. I was able to get a copy of it. SharePoint 2013 will install on that. It is not supported, which just means that if you call Microsoft crying because it doesn't work, they're probably going to make fun of you and then hang up. But it does install. The prerequisite installer doesn't run. You need to do some funny business to get that working. You need to install your stuff manually. But it looks like that's going to work for us. Those are the versions of Windows that it runs with. The good news is you don't need to do a lot of tweaking to the OS. Get it installed, hit Windows Update, download the 73 patches or so that have come out since you updated it last time. Put it in the domain, and that's all you need. That's all you have to do. And then SharePoint comes with the prerequisite installer that installs all of the software that you need to have on that box before you install SharePoint, and does some tweaking, configures IIS, and it installs all the patches except for the ones that it doesn't install. And that's on that blog post right there, the first of many references to my blog. If you're installing this on Windows 2008 R2, there are three Windows patches that you need to install. If you're installing this on Windows 2012, there's one patch that you have to install. If you didn't put those on before you installed SharePoint, it's okay. You can install them after the fact. They just tweak some little things inside of the operating system. Also, those are probably going to get rolled into Windows updates at some point. So if you try to install that patch and it tells you it's already there, don't freak out. Everything's good.
So in addition to the Windows prerequisites that are required for SharePoint 2013, SharePoint will run on certain versions of SQL. We've got SQL 2008 R2 Service Pack 1 as a minimum, and that's going to be standard enterprise or data center editions, as well as SQL 2012 on standard BI or data center editions, with SQL 2012 Service Pack 1 being the requirement for business intelligence bits. Even though SharePoint 2013 will run on SQL 2008 R2, you will miss out on some of the features, the advanced features of SharePoint 2013, such as the 2013 Access service application functionality, as well as the SQL 2012 SSRS functionality that comes built in.
Yeah. Plus, you're just less cool if you do that. Your friends will think less of you. It's easily preventable, though.
And just a note, since all of your content, or primarily most of your content, should be stored within your SQL content databases, the SQL server itself is going to be the largest factor in the performance of your farm, so make sure to keep that in mind when you're actually building out the sizing of your servers.
Yep. Did any of you go to a session this week that some guys from Microsoft did on installing SharePoint on Azure? Any of you go to that? What did they say that the number one thing they did to tweak performance was? Do you remember? SQL. TempDB, specifically, was at least when I saw it in New Orleans. So they had everything going on Azure, and SharePoint was running along, humming along, and they said, okay, we got a baseline now. Let's see what we can do to rev this thing up a little bit. So the first thing they did was they split out their TempDBs on different spindles. Performance shot through the roof. And then they split out their content DBs into file groups and split those out onto four different spindles, and performance shot through the roof. All of your performance comes from SQL, with one exception. I did have a SharePoint 2010 farm about a year ago that a customer called, and they were complaining that SharePoint was slow, which, who here's heard that before? Yeah, SharePoint's slow. It's, sun rises, water's wet, SharePoint's slow. So I jumped in, and SharePoint was really slow. So I started poking around. Would anybody like to guess how many gig of RAM that SharePoint 2010 server had? Dos, as they say here in Spain. They had a production SharePoint 2010 server with 2 whole gigabytes of RAM all to itself. So if that's the case, then your performance is not coming from SQL. SQL's not your bottleneck. But if you have a reasonable amount of hardware, then SQL is where your performance is going to come from. So to take a look into that, go out, do any kind of binging for SQL performance. Just make sure you're doing some of those best practices. SharePoint will love you for it if you do. So speaking of RAM, these are the minimum hardware requirements for SharePoint from Microsoft. Now, if you look at the minimum hardware requirements for like Windows 7, it's something like half a gig of RAM or 1 gig of RAM. And when you look at the minimum hardware requirements, you're like, there's no way I would do this. This is ridiculous. I'm not going to run Windows 7 on 1 gig of RAM. And then you see the minimum memory requirements for SharePoint, and you see 12 gig, and you're like, I can get by on 8, easy. These are minimums for a reason, so pay attention to them. One thing that we've seen over the last few years as virtualization has just really become the mainstay, we got a lot of customers who their rule is everything is virtualized, everything. And when that happens, we see people getting really stingy on hardware, because if they take all of their SharePoint servers and dial them back from 12 gig to 11 gig, well, they've just freed up 8 or 9 gig to put on other VMs. So take these minimums to heart. How many of you are at the mercy of another team for virtualization? How many of you have to justify your, okay. So we see this a lot, and we see our SharePoint brethren coming to the virtualization team and saying, I need a bunch of VMs, and they all need 12 gig of RAM. And the virtualization team says, there is no way I'm giving you 12 gig of RAM. Can't do it. So I tell you what, I'll give you 6 gig of RAM, and we'll watch SharePoint, and if it stays busy and uses all the RAM, then we'll give you 7, and then maybe we'll give you 8, and we'll dial up that way. You have to earn the RAM. So I had this conversation with a customer in their virtualization team once, and I said, I like your idea. I like your idea of only using the amount of RAM that SharePoint needs, but let's go the other direction. You give me my 12 gig, and in a month, if my server's not using it, then we can dial it back. And that shut them up. Because here's what happens. With SharePoint, it tries to be a good citizen. It tries to be responsible with the resources of the server that it's on. And if the server is memory starved, SharePoint starts shutting things off. It starts recycling app pools early. It tries to make itself fit into the amount of RAM that you have. So if you try to wedge it into 8 gig, it might run, it just won't run well. So be very careful with those. Those minimums are there for a reason. Another one, the hardware minimums for a C drive from Microsoft are 80 gig. I tell people 100 gig's probably pretty reasonable. There's a certain part of SharePoint that you can't get off of the C drive, the SharePoint root, that C, program files, common files, whatever, 15. Will always be on the C drive. You can't move that. But that's only gonna be a couple of gig. That 80 gig is not for SharePoint. That 80 gig is for everything else. For Windows patches and everything else you install on Windows, your antivirus software and all that kind of stuff. Every one of those patches that caches the other version of the patches, that's what that 80 gig's there for, so that Windows can stay happy. It's not for SharePoint. And I like to recommend having a second drive, call it the D drive, E drive, whatever, and I move everything I can off onto that drive. SharePoint logs, IIS logs, search query files, all that kind of stuff onto this other drive. And then gigabit Ethernet, you need that between all of your servers. Of course, these days, 10 gig Ethernet's starting to come out. The faster those servers can talk to each other, the happier they are. And Microsoft says they need to be within 1 millisecond of latency of each other. And so that they published that because we had people trying to do some crazy disaster recovery scenarios where they would have 2 SharePoint servers in Madrid here and then 2 other SharePoint servers in Paris as part of a DR strategy, but they would all be in the same farm. And SharePoint 2010 and 2013 just don't like that very much. So Microsoft put down some hard boundaries and said they need to be within 1 millisecond of each other. So like I said, we've kind of turned the corner on this virtualization thing. If you had seen this talk for SharePoint 2007 or for SharePoint 2010, we would have cautioned you not to virtualize everything. That's kind of gone. Everybody virtualizes everything. That's just the way that it is. Virtualization software has become pretty good. So we're gonna be doing that. But like I said, don't be stingy with your hardware. Be careful with things like overcommitting RAM on your virtualization hosts. Be careful about doing things like thin provisioning your drives. I've got a great story. I had a customer who was running SharePoint 2007 at the time, but they wanted to try SharePoint 2010. So I got on a GoToMeeting, a WebEx with them, and their content database in SQL was 7 gig. Remember this number. This is an important number. And I looked at their SQL box, and the SQL box had a backup drive, and it had 40-some gig free. 7 goes into 40 at least 6 times. Well, 5, whatever. And so I said, okay, well, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to back this database up, and we're going to take it over to the SharePoint 2010 server, mount it up, see what happens. So we back it up, we start chatting, and all of a sudden, the RDP window goes away to his SQL box. And he says, what just happened? Like, I don't know. I saw the same thing you did. He said, well, is it still running? Is everything okay? And I'm like, well, that kind of is determined by why we lost that window. I'm not sure. And then I heard his phone ring. And SharePoint was down. So that kind of answered the question about what SQL was doing. And then somebody came next door and email was down. So what had happened was they had virtualized their SQL servers and their SharePoint servers or file servers or Exchange servers all on one big VMware host, and they thin provisioned all the drives. So while that SQL box thought it had 40 some gig free, it had less than 7 gig free. And so when I started that backup, it filled up the host's drive and every VM in that company shut off. I took the whole company down with a 7 gig backup file. So they got everything squared away. The virtualization guy came in and deleted some snapshots and did some stuff, fixed the server. And so we got back in, we RDP back in, I start the backup. Anybody want to guess what happened? Everything went down again. So at that point, I'm like, you got things going on that I can't help with right now. So I got a hold of them a couple weeks later. But the lesson from that is don't thin provision drives. Be very careful about that if you can. And also when you're doing that, watch out for snapshots. So if you're doing any kind of automatic snapshots, those will fill up your drives too. Some of the tiers of SharePoint virtualize better than others. Web4N boxes, they're mostly memory, little CPU, not a lot of disk. Your application servers, especially search, are gonna be very intense, so make sure you do those correctly. And SQL Server, be very, very careful. Who here has virtualized SQL servers? Who's virtualized them well? It's tough. Yeah, look at that guy, he's confident. I like your confidence. It's really tough to virtualize SQL well because SQL does so many things. I swear there are parts of SQL that are written in machine language that are just, it's just a really tough application to virtualize well. And where did we hear that all of our performance comes from? SQL. So we got to be careful with that. One of the best resources that I've found is there's a bunch of videos for the SQL MCM readiness class. So it's for those folks who want to take the SQL MCM class. And there's one on virtualization. It's out on TechNet. I should have a link up here, but I don't. And it's done by a guy named Brent Ozar. And he talks all about virtualizing SQL. It's about 60, 70 minutes long. My recommendation for you is to get that video, get your SQL DBA and your virtualization guide, get them in a dark room, pop some popcorn, watch that video, because you're going to learn stuff. You're going to learn stuff on virtualizing SQL. Like it's possible to make SQL perform worse by adding more virtual CPUs, things like that. So talk about that. One of the interesting things that Brent says in there is he's talking about virtualizing hard drives. And he says, should we use virtual hard drives or should we use pass-through disks? He said, obviously pass-through disks give you better performance, but if you've already decided to virtualize SQL, you're obviously not terribly concerned about performance, so we're not going to worry about that. We're going to tell you to use virtual disks because then you can do a bunch of the disaster recovery stuff. So that was an interesting comment that, if you virtualize SQL, you've already given up. But there's the hardware requirement document, and there was a session on virtualizing SharePoint in North America. I don't know if that made it over here or not. But the good news is the North American content is available for free, so you can just go out and watch it right now if you want to.
So here we have some additional products that are great for extending the functionality of SharePoint. So you can use Project Server 2013 to be able to do tracking and management of Microsoft Project.
I think the guys before us were just talking about Project. We should have went the other way with these.
So the minimum requirement in order to run Project is obviously it's going to be a SharePoint 2013 Enterprise. Then we've got SQL reporting services. Requires SQL 2012 if you want to be able to do reporting services with SharePoint 2013. The SQL reporting services actually installs as a service application now.
How many of you installed SQL SSRS before 2012? Wasn't that just a massive pain? It was, all this, install this here, install that there. Yeah, they finally got it figured out, and it's finally a service application, which is how it should have been from the beginning.
Then we have Office Web Applications. So Office Web Apps is slightly different, mostly different, I guess, from 2010. So in 2010, SharePoint 2010, Office Web Applications had to be installed on an actual SharePoint server. They've now reversed that, and now it's Office Web Applications cannot be installed on a SharePoint server.
Just to keep you on your toes, keep you guessing.
Yeah. And so one of the benefits of that is that Office Web Apps servers, now you can now use that to integrate in with your Link services, your Exchange services, as well as SharePoint, individually or all together. As far as the licensing for Office Web Applications, To be able to read documents within SharePoint through the Office Web Applications interface. There's no licensing required for that. It's free. If you want to be able to create and edit content, then you need to be licensed at the client, I believe with Office 2013, correct?
Yeah, you need Cal. So the way that works is, the Office Web Apps didn't exist until Google Docs existed. And then everybody said, oh, these Google Docs are great. I can edit all my documents in the browser. This is awesome. I'll never use Office again. And then Microsoft came out with the Office Web Apps. So like Corey said, read is free. That's how they get you. They get you in. It has to be installed on its own server. Corey mentioned that it cannot be installed on a SharePoint server. It can't be installed on any other server. And as an only child, I can sort of understand that. I need my space. I don't need other things touching my stuff. So I can see where the Office Web Apps are coming from. What it comes down to is when you uninstall the Office Web Apps, it essentially wipes out IIS. So if you were to find a way to install this onto your SharePoint box or your Exchange box or something, anytime you ever did any maintenance with the Office Web Apps and pulled them off of that box, it would erase everything else on that box. So the Office Web Apps are free, but they do require a license for Windows because you got to run them on your own box. If you want to do the create and edit, and everybody does, your users need to be licensed for the Office clients. So I think it's Pro Plus or Premium or something that gives you that Office Web App create and edit license. And the way SharePoint handles this is kind of nice. In SharePoint land, we've always had trouble with licensing. Like if we had a SharePoint Enterprise farm, and those cows were a bunch of money, if we had users that just needed team site functionality, foundation functionality, we couldn't use them on that same farm because there was no way to keep them from using the enterprise bits. 2013 handles that well. And for the Office Web Apps, what they've done is they've added licensing modes. So if you've got some folks that can do create and edit and some folks that can only do read, what you do is you create a domain group that has all of the users that have Office licenses for create and edit. And then there's a PowerShell commandlet that you use that says, this group can create and edit. And that tells SharePoint who's who. So if I only have read access, but Corey has write and edit, when I go to a page, Office Web Apps will render things in the browser, and I can page through them, I can do all the read stuff, but all the links to edit them or change anything just won't exist. Corey logs into the same site, it sees he's in that group, and he can do everything. So that's a really great way that they've got that. How many of you guys already have SharePoint 2013 stood up? Good chunk of you. How many of you are using the Office Web Apps? Not all of you. So I highly recommend the Office Web Apps. The functionality is amazing. I guarantee that your users will love it. Don't be surprised if there's maybe a parade in your honor, gifts thrown at your feet, because it's really great functionality. And the workflow is fun because I've been using SharePoint for a while, and I'm a big fan of SharePoint Search, but there was always this clumsy dance that happened when I did a query. So if I did a search for something, and I'd get a page full of results, I'd click the top one, Word would open, I would read through, that wasn't the thing, I'd close Word, I'd scroll, I'd click another one, Word would open, I'd read the document. Kind of got clumsy. So with Office Web Apps now, on search result pages, on even document library pages, I can open up the document and just have it pop up inside of my browser. And with Word documents, I can page through them. With PowerPoint documents like this one, I can thumb through the slides. And I can do it all inside the browser. I don't have to wait for my app to open up. I don't have to do page refreshes. It's all right inside of that. Your users will love it. Also, if you have any devices, like Android devices or iPads and all that, they can render this stuff too. Now, in the past couple of weeks, Microsoft has released Office for the Apples, so I don't know how well that works, but this kind of stuff is just HTML5. There's nothing fancy about it. So if you've got these bring-your-own-device folks, it will work on there too. If you want to watch a video of one of our folks walking through the installation and the configuration, you can go to that GoToMeeting link. It's going to ask you to register. It's completely free. But just register, and then you can watch the thing. It's 70 minutes or something like that. Walks through the installation, the configuration. If you do install the Office Web Apps, one recommendation that I have is that you put the March 2013 public update on the Office Web Apps. The Office Web Apps out of the chute were pretty cool. They did Word and Excel and Access and OneNote and all that kind of fun stuff. With the March 2013 public update to the Office Web Apps, they added PDF viewing. So now, without a PDF viewer on your desktop or anything, if there are PDF files in SharePoint, you can render them inside of the browser, page through them, do all that fun stuff. And then if you want to edit those, then what it does is it can, in the background, it converts that PDF to a Word document and then opens up the Word web app. So that's the March public update. Pretty good stuff there. Corey, tell them about PowerPivot.
So lastly, there's PowerPivot, which is a sort of a specialized install of SQL Server analysis services. So this actually has to be installed as well on a SharePoint server, and it installs itself as a service application in SharePoint. So this is great for being able to pull in data from analysis services as cubes and be able to slice and dice your data and relate different data sets.
Yep. My wife's an accountant, and I remember when Office 2010 came out, that was the first version we had that had 32-bit and 64-bit. And so being a nerd, I went and installed the 64-bit version. Nothing worked. It was terrible. So I uninstalled and installed the 32-bit version, and I was telling my wife this because, you know, she loves to hear about these great stories. And I said, the 64-bit version is worthless. It doesn't add anything. And she's like, well, what does it do? I'm like, oh, it lets you do this. And, it, you know, apparently Excel has some limit of like 65,000 rows, and it gets rid of that. She's like, it does? You can get rid of that? I'm like, you have spreadsheets where that's come up? So these accounts of people like that do these crazy things with these huge data sets. And what PowerPivot lets you do is pull these data sets into RAM and start manipulating them without having to churn through all these numbers real time. So if you've got big groups of numbers, cubes, things like that, Power Pivot's the way to churn through that easily with SharePoint. So here are our service applications inside of SharePoint, and I broke this down into about the ugliest slide that I could, so you're all very welcome for that. The ones that have asterisks next to them are ones that can be federated from one farm to another. So if you've got an environment that's really big, you've got like a centralized IT and then maybe business groups that have their own IT groups, the ones that have asterisks next to them, central IT could stand up a SharePoint farm and it could do all of the company's search, for instance. And then the individual business units could fire up their own SharePoint servers, farms, and consume those federated search results. The ones with databases are the ones that, or the ones with a little database sign have databases next to them. And you'll notice that that's a lot of the same service applications because the ones that you want to federate are the ones that have data, not necessarily the ones that do stuff. So you'll see that there's a lot of familiar faces there from SharePoint 2010. So we've got a couple of new ones though. We've got Machine Translation Service. And I can tell you as a guy that lives in the middle of the United States, where 2,000 miles in every direction, everybody speaks English, translation services aren't a big deal for me. But for you guys, that's pretty cool. So the translation service is a way to automatically translate content inside of SharePoint using the Bing translation services. So you can get this all set up, you can tie it to one of your online accounts, your Microsoft account, and you can have a job that runs that goes out and does translations of your documents from Spanish to French or Spanish to English or whatever. Now, we've all seen automatic translation services and the hilarity that comes from those. You can go in afterwards and tweak them and make them less hilarious, but that's a new one that we've got. We've got a couple on the enterprise SKU there. We've got Access Services, which is not the same as Access Services in SharePoint 2010. That's been renamed to Access 2010. Access Services now, there's apparently a session going on right now. Thanks to all of you for coming here instead of that one. But Access 2013 can now be used to build these SharePoint apps that we've been hearing so much about. So you can use Access 2013, build things and publish it out into SharePoint, and then your end users can consume that functionality. Have any of you guys installed and configured that? How did that go for you, sir? Thumbs up, thumbs down. Yeah. Yeah, I think the document to install that's 30-some pages. That's a pretty rough installation. If you do want to do it, and I recommend that you try it in a test environment, but you're going to want to stand up a separate SQL instance for Access 2013. Access 2013 creates a database for every single app that somebody builds. So imagine you get this all configured and you unleash it to the wild and you get somebody in, you know, HR or something, and they start spinning up all these specialized apps. Every single one of those is going to be its own database in SQL. And on top of that, you have to do some just evil things to your SQL instance before Access 2013 to even be able to get in there and create those databases. It makes you do unnatural things that I would never do to my SharePoint SQL instance. So try it, play with it, but do it in a test environment, an environment you don't care very much about. So I'm hoping that maybe with some service packs, that process gets a little less bad. But for backward compatibility, we have the Access 2010 one. We've got Performance Point, we've got Visio. But that's kind of, it's the same cast of characters, essentially. I don't think we have. So one of the things I wanted to mention, you'll notice everybody's friend, the user profile service, is still there. It still has all of its databases. I have bad news and good news about the user profile service. Any of you guys do battle with the user profile service in 2010? Did you finally get it whipped? You had to do some tricks and tweaks and all that. So the bad news is that the user profile service has not changed in SharePoint 2013. I haven't done like a file compare on all the files, but it's exactly the same with one very small exception. That's the bad news. But the good news is all those hard lessons you learned and all those tweaks you've got hidden in a OneNote file somewhere, you get to keep using them. That wasn't a waste. All those great tricks are going to come in handy when you configure this for SharePoint 2013. So you got that going for you. The one change in the user profile service is that they've added back a read-only sync from AD. So in SharePoint 2007, if you set up a user profile sync, it was simple. My daughter could have done it, and she can't tie her shoes yet. All you did was you put in your domain name, you hit import, you hit OK, you leaned back, put your hands behind your head, put your feet up on your desk, and everything just worked. With 2010, we had this user profile thing. It took a long time. There was swearing involved. It was a very ugly process. And then it took a long time to bring all your users in. So what they've added in 2013 is they've added this SharePoint 2007 style of import. So it's very bare bones. You can't write back to Active Directory or anything like that. But what it does do is it configures very easily, and it syncs very quickly. So to make things as confusing as possible, one of them is called the user profile import. The other one is called the SharePoint import. And you're working with the user profile service on SharePoint, so how in the world do those two terms be different things? But the SharePoint import is the old one, the fast one. And you can just switch back and forth between them. So if you say, hey, this whole fast import thing sounds like a good idea, you can configure the SharePoint import. And then if that's not what you want, you can switch it over to the user profile import and get the full sauce. Work management's another one in there. That's a new one, that one at the bottom on the left. That's a great thing. If you're running Project 2013 and Exchange 2013, you can create this work management service app, and it takes all of the things that you haven't got done every place in your environment and puts them all in one big nasty list in your user profile, so you can see the things that project's waiting on you. You can see your tasks in Exchange. There's really nothing to configure. You just set it up, and it just works. But that's kind of nice.
A couple of additional ones that are used now in 2013 as well as the subscription settings service app.
Yeah.
So previously in 2010, that was only used for multi-tenant sort of features in order to tie a subscription to a site collection, which would then partition all of its information within search or manage metadata, any of that kind of stuff. Now the subscription settings service in 2013 is actually used for the app management service, which is part of the whole new app model that Microsoft has added to the to SharePoint 2013.
Yep, so everybody gets to play with the subscription setting service now as part of the app management stuff. So let's talk about, we've talked about the hardware you need, we've talked about the software you need, we've talked about the things that you can install. Let's talk a little bit about where things go and how you can install them. So traditionally you see the tiers of SharePoint described this way. You've got the web front end tier, which is the one that the end users beat on when they request SharePoint pages. That's just a server with SharePoint installed on it in your farm. That one is one of the two or three things inside of SharePoint that SharePoint does not automatically load balance. So if you have more than one web front end, you're going to need to use Windows network load balancing service or an F5 box. Those guys, I think, have a booth down there. Something intelligent box to direct that traffic. One of the things that the documentation said is for SharePoint 2013 that there's a change that if you do have a load balancing setup, that you don't need to configure affinity or stickiness or any of those things. Previous versions of SharePoint had a requirement that if you had multiple web front end boxes, whatever it was that was splitting your traffic up, when a conversation started from a user to a box, all the traffic had to go to that box, or else funny things happened, things didn't show up on the pages, that kind of stuff, because of the stateless service of SharePoint. Well, now we have this distributed cache thing that runs in the background. Microsoft tells you that you don't need to do that affinity thing anymore. My experience has been that you kind of do. Things seem to work a little better. So if you're having problems and you've read that stuff and you set your load balancer up, try turning the affinity on or the stickiness or whatever and see if that doesn't clear any of the problems up. The next tier is the application server, and that's really just kind of a generic term for anything that's not a web front end. You can have, you know, managed metadata, business connectivity services, search on one of these application servers. Just another tier back. The good news about SharePoint is it's really flexible. So the way you turn an application server into a web front end server is you get some pixie dust and you sprinkle. No, you just go in to that server and you just turn on the web front end role and poof, it's a web front end. So it's very flexible, very nimble. You can do all those things that you want to. One significant difference from SharePoint 2013 or from SharePoint 2010 is search. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that in later slides, but search is a monster in SharePoint 2013. The functionality is killer. It does some amazing things, but SharePoint needs its pound of flesh to do that. And search has five roles that it does, and every one of those processes fires up a node runner process on the server. And those five, they get together and they're just like a gang. They just steal all the resources on that box. You're going to steal all your CPU, steal all your RAM. So if you're doing anything with search, one of the first moves you're going to want to make is get search off of your application box and get it on its own box, so that when it starts to chew all the resources up on that box, it only impacts search. It doesn't take down your web front end. It doesn't take down user profile service or any of that. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a couple of slides on how to do that. Database server, we've already talked about that. Any supported version of SQL, it can be on there. You can have multiple SQL servers. So Corey told you that you needed SQL 2012 SP1 to do the fun BI stuff, which is true. But maybe because of licensing, you don't want to put all your databases on that because of your licensing by CPU or something. You can have your content databases on a SQL 2008 R2 box, and your BI stuff on a SQL 2012 box, and maybe your search database is on a third SQL box somewhere. You can have multiples, so long as they're all supported, the permissions are all set up correctly. And for high availability, you can use any SQL trick that you'd like, mirroring, transaction log, shipping, always on availability groups, any of that kind of stuff. SharePoint's pretty understanding. All it cares about is the instance name and the database name. If it can connect to that, it's pretty happy. So any of those kind of things that you can do to make SQL more resilient, it supports probably.
So now we're going to walk through some of the different levels of architecture that you can do using SharePoint based on various sort of use cases. So notice that we skipped right over the single server all-in-one box. Don't be that guy. You don't want to do that in a production environment. No standalone installs. No SharePoint and SQL on the same box. SharePoint and SQL are both heavy hitters when it comes to resource utilization. You don't want to have to figure out who's fighting who on resource contention.
Yeah, for demos like this, I've been doing these sessions for years. That was our mainstay, right? The single server box that had AD and had SQL and had SharePoint and had everything on it. And with 2007, that worked really well. And then 2010 came out and it worked kind of well if you shut some stuff off and watched what was going on. But you could sort of make it work. With 2013, it's a recipe for heartache. So we don't even talk about it anymore because it's just, SharePoint 2013 is just too much of a pig. So we left it out. Go ahead and tell them anything special about that one. You'll notice that, this is kind of cheating. You're probably thinking that I use the Spanish word up there because we're in Spain. Actually, the company that we work for is based in San Antonio, Texas. So we threw that in a while back because of that. But, trying to throw a little shout out there. So we basically got two boxes. One box has everything SharePoint, one box has SQL. Not much to it.
So in this environment here, so assume this is your corporate intranet. Your SharePoint environment has grown to maybe say 10 to 15,000 users, but you've only got a little bit of data. Maybe you've got 50 to 100 gigs of data. So what you do is you load balance two web front ends and then store your data in SQL. The web front ends themselves are able to host the query and the search indexing roles because a small amount of data, it's really not going to have that much of an impact on your end user's experience.
Yeah. So we deal in hosting. So we do consulting. So we will, you know, help you with SharePoint on premises, but we also do hosting. And one of the things that comes up when we talk to customers, like, oh, we think you need two SharePoint boxes. And they say, that sounds like a money grab. Your salesman said I need two. I don't trust those guys. What's up with that? Why would I need a second SharePoint server? So the answer to that question is the same two answers that is the case for any of these things. Adding that second server gives you one of two things. It gives you increased capacity. So like Corey said, maybe SharePoint has become the most popular application in your company. You're heralded as a genius and indispensable in your company. And SQL or SharePoint needs more capacity because everybody's going there. You add another server to split the load. The other thing that adding a second server gives you is fault tolerance. So maybe SharePoint's not hit really hard all the time, but when they need to hit SharePoint, they need to hit SharePoint. So then you add a second server just in case the first server goes down. So as you're scaling out your own architectures and asking yourself, maybe I should have more of this server or more of that server, the answer to that question is always, do I need more capacity or do I need more resilience? And those are the two reasons that you add servers. So like Corey said, the main reason that people go from this to this is, you know, capacity. Now, one of the things that we can do with SharePoint 2013 is we can run everything on both servers. Previous versions of SharePoint had some limitations about what you could have more than one copy of things. SharePoint 2013 is pretty understanding about that. There's a couple of little exceptions, things like the user profile sync service instance can only run on one server per service app. So if the one of those two servers that had the sync service on it was the one that crashed, you would just start that on the other one. Everything would be fine.
Assuming it would start.
Yes, assuming you could get it to start. That is an awfully big assumption, that's true. So assuming the stars were aligned and you were facing the right direction and you'd had the right thing for breakfast and you could get it to start, there'd be no downtime, there'd be no loss of functionality. Also notice that when I said before that I was good at PowerPoint, I lied, because when I made that arrow on the top, or that line on the top, for the life of me, I couldn't get the arrow pointing the other direction. I tried for about 30 minutes and something shiny caught my attention and I just gave up. So that in no way, shape, or form is indicative of how the traffic actually flows. It's just an indicator that I'm an idiot when it comes to PowerPoint. So ignore the arrows.
So más tres.
I have no idea if that's even grammatically correct.
So, it's probably not. So here we've got a similar three server configuration. The difference here is that now we've got less users. We don't have nearly as many users accessing our SharePoint environment, but our data instead, maybe it's an architectural firm or something, but our data has grown over 500 gigs to a terabyte or whatever. So what begins to end up happening is that your web front end starts to get slowed down by the search crawls. It just starts getting pounded and also being able to try to feed queries to your end users, that kind of stuff. The ideal situation here is then to peel off your search components, put them on their own server away from the web front end to increase that user experience.
Yep. So, and this is one of the things I recommend to people is getting that off. So let's say that you've done this, you've done the trace, and you're feeling pretty good about yourself, everything's good, but search, man, once in a while, when that thing kicks in, it really bogs everything down and it takes both boxes down. And more than anything, you wish you'd have done this. Now that you see it, you're like, oh, how did I miss that? Todd and Corey are geniuses. How big of a deal is it to go from this to this? And boy, do I love this little clicker. Not a big deal at all. So if you start with this, all you do is you pick one of the servers, whichever one is going to have search. You go into the other one, and you shut off all the search. And poof, you've got that. That's all there is to it. SharePoint's that flexible. Now, notice that I didn't say shut off the web front end role from the search server. And you'll notice I've got the web front end role on the search server on there. The reason that I do that is because search, when it kicks off, is going to pound the web front end server for as many pages as it can, as fast as it can. And so one of the things that I do to keep search from taking down the web front end that my users are using is I always point the search server at itself. Because when the search server does its crawling and its indexing, it just uses HTTP. It's the same way you do with a browser. It doesn't have any secret way into the database or anything like that. It's just hitting it. And so in cases like this, it's probably going out to your hardware load balancer, coming back in. So in this situation right here, I've gone into the search server, and on the host file, I've pointed all of the web apps in SharePoint at that box for that server. So when it kicks in, it hits itself. Yes, sir? Does that apply to 2010 as well? I would say that applies to 2010, 2007, 2003 sort of, but search was different. I will tell you as a matter of practice, every time I install SharePoint, I point every SharePoint server at itself. But search is one of the reasons that I do that. So, yeah. So that's all there is to it as we grow. So even if you started here, you had this, SharePoint got popular, you decided that the capacity needed to be expanded, you just install SharePoint in another box, add it to the farm, magically you have that. You find out now, you know, you've got a lot of documents, the crawls are causing problems, the queries are causing problems, flip a couple of switches, and now you've got that. Easy peasy, no reinstallation, no URLs change.
So then we come to this situation here where you've actually combined the last two slides together. So now we've got 10 to 15,000 users, somewhere around a terabyte of data. Search is still peeled off in its own role, and then the web front ends are running all the service applications.
Yep. And so now why did we add another web front end? Either capacity or resilience. Do you have a question, sir? So what about the caching service? So new to SharePoint 2013 is the distributed cache. For the most part, for small environments like this, I don't touch it. Now, there are some limits to, you can actually have too much RAM for the distributed cache. You can actually have it running on too many servers. But in these kind of environments, that's probably not the case. I don't normally tweak it. There's a pretty good white paper from Microsoft that talks about the distributed cache and what things to do with it. But I'll be honest, I'm kind of afraid of it. And I'm afraid if I poke it once with a stick, it's going to just take SharePoint down. Have you had any problems with it? Have you had to tweak it? You have? In an environment this small? If you think about it, shoot me an email and explain what happened. So the next time this question comes up, I can tell them your tale of woe. I would love to know. But shoot me an email. But I've had pretty good luck. All right. So this one, again, we just fired up another VM, installed SharePoint, pointed it at our farm, and then added another web front end, brought that load balancer back into the mix, and off we went. Here I ran out of Spanish numbers, so I had to start making words up. So this is not something you would probably actually do, but this is a slide that's more talking points. So now we've got a lot of things going on. We've turned a lot of the pieces of SharePoint on, and we need to start partitioning things out. And one of the differences from our previous slide is now we don't have one, but we have two search boxes in the top right there. Top right. And so those two boxes now we're doing search. So we would do something like that if, for instance, our crawls took too long. So if our crawl, like let's say a full crawl takes a week, and you shouldn't have to do full crawls very often, but stuff comes up. There are things that you change inside of search that require full crawls, but you've got so many documents that it takes too long to do a crawl. So you add a second server because they can share the crawl. Or maybe you have a really heavy search-driven application. You've got the content by search web part, or you're doing some of the catalog stuff that Microsoft likes to demo. You need some big iron behind that to keep that all running. But we need that to be off of our other servers. So the two servers below that, they're running our service apps. They're doing the user profile. They're doing the business data connectivity. They're doing the managed metadata, any of that kind of stuff. And one of the things that we've done is since search is so heavy and those databases are getting hit so much, they were causing contention with our content databases. So we moved search off onto their own databases because search has, three or four databases. Now they're down there. So if search freaks out, it just takes that SQL instance and makes it slower, but content still comes up. And then we've got our web front ends and our regular SQL server. Any questions about this one? I think the first thing I want to talk about on this slide is the fact that I remembered the first exclamation point and that as an American I was able to figure out how to make it. I think that's a big step forward for me. So this one, again, is just another set of talking points of things that we can do. We've got search pulled out because of its stuff. We've also got a distributed cache group. So like this guy was talking about, distributed cache can be kind of fussy, and it was causing problems. We had too many servers on our farm, so we pulled two servers out. We dumped, I think, 12 gig of RAM, something like that, in them. Put the distributed cache on there, shut it off everywhere else. We're doing some heavy BI stuff. Some of the things like performance point and all that are really CPU intensive, and they were causing problems on our other servers. So we pushed those off onto their own boxes. We got search. We've broken our databases out now. Search gets its own cluster now, so it's highly available. The BI pieces get their own servers because some of that back-end SQL stuff happens. So this is, I don't think we have any farms that match this exactly, but this is some of those steps. Any questions about the Mas Grande? Nice. I did that with the upside down. Yeah, it's good stuff. All right, so that's good. Any questions about architecture before we move on to other things without me slaughtering the Spanish language? All right. So when I talk to folks about installation, I like to think of there being four stages to a good installation. The prerequisite installer runs all those. Don't forget the forgotten prerequisites, and don't forget to visit my blog for information on that. So that's the first step. You do that on all your servers, and you can do it on all the servers at the same time. Get your RDP windows open, next, hit them all. The next step is actually laying down the SharePoint bits. That's just getting them on there, running your install, picking a good farm install. Again, you can do that on all your servers at once. It doesn't matter. If you're going to install any language packs, now would be a good time to do all that. If you're going to install any patches like the March 2013 public update for SharePoint, which Microsoft has said they consider that the base for SharePoint 2013. And no patches after that will install if it's not installed. And so I can tell you for sure that I tried to install the April 2013 CU on an RTM version of SharePoint 2013 and it would not install. So I think they're serious about this. The June 2013 CU for SharePoint Server has not come out yet, so I haven't had a chance to test that. But get all those bits laid down and get that so that we know, that's all the same. The third step is to create the farm or configure the farm. And that's going to be with that wizard that tries to run after the install. But you guys look like you might be smarter than the average bear, so I think you're probably ready to do it with PowerShell. You can create your farm with PowerShell. There are two distinct advantages to doing it with PowerShell. The first is the feeling of superiority that comes from the fact that you created your farm with PowerShell, and you really can't put a price on that. The second thing is if you create your farm with PowerShell, you can prevent that admin database from having a GUID at the end of it. Now, does anybody here like GUIDs at the end of their databases? Make you feel? No, nobody likes it. GUIDs mothers don't even like them. They're so horrible. The only way to prevent that is to create your farm with PowerShell. Now, I've got a blog post on that, and I cannot believe I did not put that on there. How did I miss that? I'm ashamed of myself. You have a couple of options. There is one PowerShell commandlet that will create your farm and create those databases. You can run that, lay that down, and then run the wizard. The wizard will know that that's all been done, and it will do the rest. Or if you're feeling particularly proud, then you can do everything with PowerShell, and I've got a blog post on how to do all that. But the thing is, if you want to get rid of that GUID, you can't run the wizard. That's only for creating the farm, so that's the first server. If you're creating a multi-server farm, you can use the wizard to add subsequent servers to the farm, because that database is already there. So that's the third stage. The fourth stage is configuring the farm after it's built. Creating web applications, creating service applications, things like that. Corey, tell them about setup.exe.
Sure. after the prerequisite installer, the first thing that you're going to run for the SharePoint bits install is going to be setup.exe. This is a process that you can run on all of your servers at one time. Nothing is actually taking place with regards to creating or configuring the farm at this point. One thing to make sure of is that you're logged in as the sp_install account for this step, and this account must be a local administrator on the box. This is to get to be able to install the bits into the required locations on the server and to be able to run the SharePoint wizard and create the actual farm. The minimum requirements for creating the farm are going to be in SQL with the DB creator, security admin, admin and the public roles. And then you can look up the service account guidelines on Todd's blog. I believe you can only shamelessly promote yourself once per slide in PowerPoint. That's why you've only got...
I think that's
the limit. Yeah.
I hit the limit of quoting my own blog in PowerPoint. That's quite possible. So that blog post there talks about all the different things. Now, I've been very careful with that. I set that up as guidelines or suggestions. It's not carved in stone. Microsoft also has a document that has the service accounts for SharePoint 2013. It differs from mine. Of course, I'm right and they're wrong, but you know, that's how that is. But have those all created before you get to this point. You know, have them created, especially if you have an Active Directory team that you need to submit this stuff to. Those guys are never in as big of a hurry as you are. So make sure you get those created. Also, a note about the SQL roles. Don't change any of the SQL roles. I've got a couple of customers who are very security conscious, and they've gone into SQL and they've tweaked those built-in roles. SharePoint doesn't know they did that, and so SharePoint thinks it can do things that it can't after they do that. So leave those roles alone. They're there for a reason. Another thing that customers have talked to me about is they don't like the idea that there is an account that is a local admin on every SharePoint box. So I've had questions about whether they can delete that account afterwards or make it not a local admin afterwards, something to reduce that security attack vector. So you will use that account anytime you install anything on your SharePoint boxes. So when the next patch comes out or you know, you get project server, you want to install that. So that account needs to be there and it needs to be a local admin. But if you are security conscious, you can disable that account in AD because nothing runs as that account if you follow the guidelines in my blog post. You only need it to log into the boxes when you install software. Other than that, you can disable it. So when you're doing your installation, when you're doing your installation, that's a good time to install any patches that you need to install. And the best place on the internet to keep track of all that is on my blog. So I've got a blog post that has all of the patches that have come out for SharePoint 2013, what their build number is, what their friendly name is, and links to the KB articles and the downloads and all that. But most importantly, I've got off to the right-hand side a link to a wiki page for every patch that tells all the things that I know that it breaks. Now, it's a good thing you're all sitting down because I'm going to tell you some information that's going to shock you all. Sometimes these patches aren't perfect and they actually break SharePoint instead of fixing it. I know, right? Who knew this? For SharePoint 2010, at least four of the patches were so bad that SharePoint pulled them out. They published them, people installed them, they left SharePoint farms in flames, and Microsoft felt bad and pulled the patch back out and made it unavailable. At least four times that happened with SharePoint 2010. So I try to keep that wiki list updated with the things that I see, that I read in blogs, and my friends tell me, I see on bathroom walls, that kind of stuff. So if you're thinking about installing a patch, go out to that list, check that wiki. Now, that's not to say that you shouldn't install any patch that has a problem, because they all have varying degrees of problems. But just make sure that if it's a problem, for instance, we had a customer that installed a patch and it broke InfoPath. Well, for them, that was a big deal, because they were a really heavy InfoPath user. But if you went out to install that patch and you saw that it broke InfoPath, and you didn't use InfoPath, you're probably okay, if it fixes the problem that you need. So my guidance on patches for SharePoint is be very careful because you can't uninstall them. There is no way to uninstall them. And you also can't just rebuild your farm and reattach your databases because if your database has a newer build number than your farm, it won't attach. So be very specific about this. You can't uninstall any of these patches. So I've got the different types of patches listed up there. When these hot fixes come out, these critical on-demand ones come out, those usually mean that there's been some security issue found that means there's people out there breaking into SharePoint servers while you're sitting there reading the article, and so you need to probably jump on that soon. But that also means that that thing got compiled quickly, and you know how our developer friends are. They get in Visual Studio, they get some mad idea about what they want to write, they hit F5, and if it compiles, they ship it. These patches are really susceptible to that. So you're kind of, you got to be careful. On one hand, it's probably a big deal. On the other hand, it's not been tested. But these are the critical on-demand patches. Got to be careful with those. The next type of patch is the cumulative update, or the CU. My guidance on those is only install them if they fix something that's broken that's bothering you. Don't just install them because they're out. Don't just install them because your buddies installed them. Only install them if you need them to fix a problem that you're having. Because like I said, they do break stuff, and they don't always break stuff immediately. I've had some customers find that out, particularly the SimplePath thing. They installed the patch to fix a different problem, and it fixed that problem. And then 3 or 4 days later, the end users came back and said, yeah, that form, that vacation request form, it doesn't do anything anymore. I can't get it to submit. And then, so now they had like a week's worth of content. They couldn't roll it back. They were stuck. So be very careful with those when you install them. Another thing that I do is I always wait at least a month before I let people put them in production. My thought on that was that if a patch comes out June 1st, that by July 1st, we should know if it's going to get pulled back. Because there was a patch, I think it's the April 2012 patch for SharePoint 2010, was out for 30 days before Microsoft pulled it. So 30 days of people installing it. So I try to tell people at least a month, let it sit out there, watch the forums, check my blog to see if there's any big problems. Have it in a test environment, play with it a little bit. You can't test everything, and nobody expects you to, but have it in a test environment, test as much as you can. And then I think karma is a big part of all this with these patches working. So if you've got a local charity that you can do some donation to, maybe volunteer some time, that seems to make these patches work better because it's a crapshoot. And finally, when service packs come out, those are tested a lot. So the cumulative updates have problems because Microsoft has to put them out every 60 days. They just don't have the resources to thoroughly test them. Service packs get tested for months and months and months. And they're pretty stable. They're in pretty good shape. Not to say they won't cause you grief, but there's less of a chance. So you want to get those installed as quickly as you can, test everything and all that. We talked about this a little bit, configuring SharePoint 2013 the way the cool kids do it. If you're in this session, if you've sat through all this, you're obviously on the ball. You can use PowerShell. So here's that link that I was talking about. So the top link is Shane, who's one of my co-authors here and often my sidekick, walking through installing and creating a farm with PowerShell. And then that link right there I made just for you guys. And it's got a bunch of scripts in it and and a Word document and all that that talks about how I build farms and then the PowerShell that I use to create those farms. So you can go out there. All those downloads are free. Tell your friends. ToddClint.com, TechEd 2013.
He only created that link just so he would have something to put on this slide.
Yeah, this slide didn't have any links to my blog, and so I had to come up with something. Mission accomplished. I think I did it. So I mentioned before that there were some pretty significant changes in search. So in 2008, 2009, Microsoft bought a search company in Norway called Fast. Fast was doing some things in search that were just amazing. I can only assume there were like trolls or elves or something involved. It was just amazing things that they did. And Microsoft wanted that in SharePoint. But they got it too late in the SharePoint 2010 product cycle to get it completely implemented correctly. The good news is it's all implemented in SharePoint 2013. So there's not a separate Fast product anymore. It's just SharePoint Search. Part of the change in that is there's a heavy reliance on PowerShell when it comes to administration. So with SharePoint 2010, we had those architecture slides, and as people moved things around, for search it was easy. You went into the search service application, you clicked the topology changes button, you jiggled some stuff around, you hit apply, and poof, search was reconfigured. In SharePoint 2013, you're going to look a really long time to find that topology button because it's not there anymore. You can't reconfigure search in Central Admin. You have to use PowerShell. And there's a bunch of other pieces of search that are like that. So get comfy with PowerShell if you're not already. There are some architectural changes. There are some new things like the analysis processing from SharePoint 2010 was pulled into search, things like that. So there's just a bunch of changes. But don't let it fool you. The interface looks very similar. The admin interface, the query interface, but under the covers, it's a whole new beast. And every one of those things that it does spins up its own Node Runner process. Has anybody had a Node Runner process steal all of your RAM or all of your CPU? I think we all have. That's just search out there, fighting the good fight, trying to get your documents all in one spot. Everybody's buddy, the user profile service. Again, almost identical to the SharePoint 2010 one, with the exception of that new sync option that we've got. And that's right there. You can see we've got the Active Directory import option right there in that dropdown, but everything else is the same. So we've got the SharePoint 2007 import option. Again, is faster, but it's a little less flexible with some of the filtering things. So again, try it out. If you don't like it, you can switch back. One of the things that I like with the SharePoint 2007, that Active Directory import mode, is the LDAP filters. Have any of you guys done any filters in the SharePoint 2010 user profile service? Did you guys stumble across that really hysterical bug where you can't delete a filter? Yeah, isn't that a great one? As far as I know, that's still broken too. So the bug was, if you created a filter in the user profile service, let's say you wanted to remove inactive accounts. You put that filter in, the idea would be that when that import happened, it would not import inactive accounts. Pretty smart. But what happens if you put the logic backwards, like one of my customers did? So they put the logic in backwards and only imported inactive accounts, which seems easy enough to fix. You just delete the rule. When you go into that page and bring that rule up and hit delete, it goes away in the page. And then you hit OK, thinking that it's actually deleted, but it never writes that change back to the user profile service, so the rule never gets deleted. So the fix for that, at least as far as I've found, is you have to add a rule to get the delete to write back. There's some other ways to do it, but that's the way that I've done it. But those rules are kind of clumsy, and there's only drop-downs. One of the things we could do with SharePoint 2007, and now 2013, is create filters based on LDAP. So we can put LDAP strings in that compiled things. And the great thing about LDAP strings is if you go into Active Directory users and computers and you start doing a search thing and you do filters, it creates an LDAP filter for you. So you can go into Active Directory users and computers, filter it down to get exactly the accounts that you want in SharePoint, copy that string out, paste it in there, poof, you're good. And of course, I have a blog post on that. So we're almost done here. This is one of my favorite pieces of SharePoint 2013. Having offline access to SharePoint is something that we've been promised for three versions now. SharePoint 2007 had a thing called Groove. Who didn't love Groove? Worked like a champ. It was awesome, except that it wasn't. It didn't work. And then in SharePoint 2010, they renamed Groove to trick us and called it SharePoint Workspaces. It didn't work very well either. But with SharePoint 2013, we've got this thing now called SkyDrive Pro. Now, let me be very clear about this. SkyDrive Pro has nothing to do with SkyDrive. Nothing to do with SkyDrive. There is no connection between them. The only reason, so I assume that they named it SkyDrive Pro for one of two reasons. Just to mess with us and confuse us. I don't think that's outside the realm of possibility. Or they meant it for you to think of it as your professional version of SkyDrive, your online documents that you can get synced local. But SkyDrive Pro is SharePoint documents offline. So to make things even more confusing, if you look up in the SharePoint 2013 interface, the link to SkyDrive Pro says SkyDrive, except when you click the SkyDrive link, you don't go to SkyDrive, you go to SkyDrive Pro. Well done, interface folks. So SkyDrive Pro is two things. Number one, SkyDrive Pro is your user, your personal site document folder. When you click the SkyDrive link, instead of going to SkyDrive, you go to your personal site collection, your document folder. That is your SkyDrive Pro folder. That's the first thing that SkyDrive Pro is. To make things even more confusing, if that was even mathematically possible, SkyDrive Pro is also the application and protocol that syncs your SkyDrive Pro folder to your desktop. So when you go in there, there's an option for syncing. You click that, it creates a SkyDrive Pro folder in Explorer, syncs all those things down. Now you say to yourself, that's not really confusing. You're in SkyDrive Pro. That makes sense. What makes it confusing is you can use SkyDrive Pro to sync any document library in SharePoint, not just the SkyDrive Pro document library in SharePoint. They really went out of their way to make this tough to use. So I've got a whole blog post on it with pictures and all that. Up until a month or so ago, you needed to have a license for Office to install SkyDrive Pro. It was part of the Office 2013. Now it's got a standalone installer, so you can do that. It works really well. It's got a few little things like you can't sync. Well, so it puts it in Explorer, so you can just drag files over and they'll get automatically synced up to SharePoint. But there's things like it doesn't know how to handle metadata. You can't put files there that you can't put in SharePoint, stuff like that. So the good news is, folks, that was our last slide. We've got 4 minutes left. Does anybody have any questions for Corey or I? Anything we didn't cover that you wanted to hear about? We answered them all. Excellent. So right after this, I think it's 6:30. Is that when that starts? Yep. There's the experts thing down somewhere over there. I'm not entirely sure where it is. Corey and I will be at the SharePoint table, wherever that ends up being. We've got a map of the tables, and SharePoint's not any of the tables, so I don't know where to go. We may end up answering Excel questions. I have no idea how that's going to go. But come down there, ask us any questions. Please fill out your event evaluations. That's how they know to invite me back, or not invite me back, as the case may be. And I think that's it.
Cool.
But thank you very much. If you have any questions, come on up, or we'll see you downstairs.